Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, our weekend edition. The House Judiciary Committee has formally voted two articles of impeachment against the President of the United States, sending it for a quick vote to the House of Representatives, which next week will make Donald Trump only the third president in American history to be impeached by the House of Representatives. So, news cycle is kind of full, and who better to talk about this than former Congressman Dave Jolly. So thanks for coming back. I appreciate it very much.
Great to be with you, Charlie.
Well, your podcast, for some reason, David, are always among the most downloaded podcasts we have. So,
scandal. It's always scandal.
We're setting the bar high. So today is Friday the 13th. Does that bother you at all? Are you like one of those guys that wouldn't get on a plane on Friday?
No, I was born on Halloween. So if there's a,
that explains,
you know,
so
if there's a fix in, I've got it somewhere.
Okay. So just in terms of anniversary dates, 1 year ago tomorrow, December 14th, 2018, the owners shut down the Weekly Standard. It was John Podoros wrote a great piece about it, calling it the murder of the Weekly Standard. And so 1 year ago today, there was this little item in Politico by Jason Schwartz, who said, editorial leaders from the magazine have been in discussion in recent days over what a possible successor publication might look like. Two people familiar with the talk said, one possibility could be to expand a small conservative site called The Bulwark, which is published by the Defending Democracy Together Institute, a nonprofit with which Bill Kristol is involved. He and Weekly Standard contributing editor Charlie Sykes already sit on the editorial board of the site, which currently lists just two editorial employees. Well, the rest, you know, is history. So that was 1 year ago today that little odd little tidbit appeared in Politico.
And Charlie, the political world is better for the presence of the Bulwark. Our conversation is more enlightened for it. And frankly, in this era of incredibly disrupted conservative politics, the Bulwark, I think, has accomplished what hopefully you set out to do, which was create a place for reasonable conservative thought and some independent thought as well. So congratulations. I appreciate having been a small part of it as a guest on your podcast.
Well, I appreciate it very much. We still miss the Weekly Standard very much, but I have to admit I'm very proud of the fact that we sort of stepped into the breach. Okay, let's get right into it today. We have the House vote coming up next week, but let's jump ahead just for a moment to the Senate and this extraordinary interview that Mitch McConnell gave to Sean Hannity.
And what you see happening and how you see this going down.
First, as you've pointed out to your viewers frequently, the Democrats have been wanting to do this for 3 years. The first headline in the Washington Post before the president was inaugurated was they were going to impeach him. Well, they finally got around to it. And we assume we're going to see two articles of impeachment, both of them pretty weak stuff, coming over to us. And your question is, what happens then? Under the rules of impeachment, the Senate then turns to it, has no option but to turn to it, and it's the sole business until we finish. How we can impact that really is just with 51 votes. The Chief Justice is in the chair. I don't expect the Chief Justice to try to tilt the playing field either way. We'll listen to the opening arguments by the House prosecutors. They will listen to the president's lawyers respond. And then we'll have to make a decision about the way forward. And everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this to the extent that we can. We don't have the kind of ball control on this that a typical issue, for example, comes over for the House. If I don't like it, we don't take it up. We have no choice but to take it up, but we'll be working through this process, hopefully in a fairly short period of time, in total coordination with the White House counsel's office and the people who are representing the president in the well of the Senate.
So, David Jolly, basically, Mitch McConnell is not even pretending. He's saying the deal is rigged. He's going to take his cues from the president's lawyers. There's no chance he's going to be removed. So the whole Senate trial is officially a sham. Your reaction?
Yeah, a shameful moment. Yeah, a shameful moment for the majority leader, Mitch McConnell. And I think as history looks back, it is up there with his handling of the Merrick Garland nomination and his comment that his goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president or his job as Senate majority leader. There's no excuse for a majority leader who will dictate much of the procedure going into the Senate trial to be coordinating with the accused, which is exactly what he's done. Donald Trump, as was voted on by House Judiciary, and if the full House agrees, will be an indicted individual. He will have been accused of wrongdoing and will be facing a trial by the United States Senate. And here you have the person with the most influence in setting the rules saying they're going to coordinate with the defendant. There really is no excuse for it, Charlie. And what it says is, as Democrats over the next coming months, if they try to convince the American people that the trial is rigged and it's fixed, they'll have a good case to make.
You know, let me push back just a little bit, because I want to put this in a different category, because I think the Merrick Bar, I know that people are upset about Merrick Garland and McConnell's comments about making Barack Obama one-term president. But to a certain extent, that is, I don't know, politics, or at least it feels like politics as usual compared to this. Because as Benjamin Wittes points out, this statement by Mitch McConnell about a constitutionally mandated trial in the Senate, it's really hard to reconcile what he said with this special oath that senators are required to take in impeachment trials under the rules. There is a specific oath that they have to take. And Mitch McConnell basically says, yeah, forget it. I mean, this thing is, I'm not open-minded. We are not going to have a fair trial. We are not interested in sifting and winnowing for the truth. The fix is in. There's a certain brazenness to this. So I guess I just want to just sort of pause to say that, because it's so easy to be numbed and say this is like this and like this. And, you know, they keep pushing the line and shattering norms that have never been shattered before.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that assessment, and certainly not Ben's. I think in terms of how we think of or define Mitch McConnell's tenure, this will be one of those three, because we will always remember those other two moments. But whether or not there's parity with those other two moments, I don't disagree with your assessment. I would say, though, and this is important, we talk often now in expecting this trial in the Senate about the Chief Justice's role. The Constitution sets the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court only as an administrator. It is still a political process, and I call it the rule of 51. Whatever 51 senators agree to, those are the rules of the trial. So there is political influence, and each senator is going to act out of their own enlightened self-interest, probably ahead of their constitutional calling, unfortunately, would be my guess. For Mitch McConnell, that is maintaining the Senate majority. For vulnerable senators like Cory Gardner of Colorado, Susan Collins of Maine, McSally, others, they will be acting in their own interest as well. And it may be that their interest is to push Mitch McConnell for a fairer process. We will have to see that play out. It will be a defining moment, not just for the modern Senate, but also for the Republican Party, given Mitch McConnell's leadership of the party long after, presumably, Donald Trump is gone.
That's a very interesting point. And I was wondering today whether or not people in the media are going to be asking other members of the United States Senate whether they agree with what Mitch McConnell just said. Because as you point out, he can only basically rig the trial if he has a majority of senators, if
That's
all
right.
the Republican senators line up, if you have a critical mass of Republican senators saying, no, I'm sorry, we are not going to shirk our constitutional duty in this particular way. Mitch McConnell does not have my support in rigging this trial. Well, then everything changes, doesn't it? So
it does. And Charlie, I think we'll see two early inflection points where we will begin to get some clarity around not just McConnell, but whether or not there's a group of 51. The first will be, I do think, should the House approve what the Judiciary Committee did today, and it's not a foregone conclusion, but it appears likely the House will impeach Donald Trump. The first inflection point will be when conservative media, Fox News, and frankly conservative elected officials begin to pressure McConnell and Republicans to table the articles or to pass what's what would be considered in a courtroom a motion to dismiss, not even bring it to trial, because under the rule of 51, they could do that. And that will be the first inflection point. The second will be on this question of witnesses. It is not Donald Trump's ability. He does not have the ability to determine who to call. That also is a function of senatorial decision making. In the Clinton impeachment, the Senate agreed to only three witnesses. It was Monica Lewinsky, Vernon Jordan, and Sidney Blumenthal. Does the United States Senate in 2019 either have no witnesses or keep the list very tight, maybe to a few we saw in the House? Or do they expand it to the wish list of Adam Schiff and Hunter Biden and Nancy Pelosi and these others that Donald Trump said? I think that will be the second inflection point to tell us how hyper-partisan is McConnell and 50 other senators, presumably all Republican, willing to make this impeachment trial.
Okay, let's talk about the House vote. The House Judiciary Committee voted on complete partisan lines, as expected, this morning, Friday morning, to advance these two articles of impeachment. You said something right before we began the podcast that I thought was really interesting. You've been paying a lot of attention. You've been listening to these folks. I guess one thing that really strikes me, though, is how bad faith the arguments that they have made. I mean, I think you can make the case that what the president did was wrong but not impeachable, or you could simply say, hey, he's our guy, he's a Republican, we're Republicans, we're just not going to go ahead with all of this. But instead, they've chosen to accept all of these fantastic conspiracy theories, and they've really contorted themselves into believing, you know, that this is somehow a plot of the deep state. And what I heard you say was you think they actually now have talked themselves into believing it, which is
extraordinary. I do.
They believe this.
Yeah, and this has been a bit of an evolution just in the last 10 days of my own assessment of my former colleagues. I used to buy some of the conventional wisdom, and I would share that conventional wisdom that somehow Trump had captured the base,
right,
and we had Republicans on Capitol Hill that were responding to the pressures from the base, and they were bargaining with themselves to support Trump and all things Trumpism. What I saw in the faces and heard in the voices and in the unreasonable arguments made by Republicans on Capitol Hill is I actually think the most vulnerable and gullible constituency in Trumpism is not the Republican base that we see at rallies. It's Republicans on Capitol Hill who are members of Congress and members of the United States Senate. I think the through line goes from Donald Trump to Republican congressmen and women to the Republican base, because what you saw in them this week was with conviction, this argument that somehow this has been an inevitable deep state ruse to get Donald Trump to finally get to an impeachable moment. When the arguments of inevitability, the narrative of inevitability is not that Democrats were inevitably going to get Donald Trump, it's that Donald Trump was inevitably going to do something to render an impeachment verdict by the U.S. House. Republicans can't see that. And I'm not sure now that there is actually any bargaining going on with themselves. I think they're true believers. And you can blame some of the cauldron of hyperpartisanship in Washington for their behavior. Whatever niceties they say, Republicans don't like Democrats and Democrats don't like Republicans on Capitol Hill right now. And so some of it is reflexive. But it also reflects, I think, a lack of mature reasoning, mature thought, introspection, as well as critical assessment of the Trump presidency by these Republican members of Congress.
Even Will Hurd?
You know, Will Hurd, I think most people would say, was a bit of a disappointment in the tact he chose to take in the intelligence hearing. I see Will Hurd's decision, if I were to make a guess, based on what I know of Will Hurd and my personal interactions with him, it was a raw political calculus.
Okay.
Though he has decided not to run for re-election, he has expressed that he has future political interests, even running for president one day. And so I think Will Hurd found a political out for taking the easy road here. Mm-hmm. And that was where you heard him flirt with the vocabulary of not proven, which is a different approach
totally
than not impeachable.
Right.
Totally different. And, you know, honestly, Jordan's amendment yesterday got to not impeachable. They just wouldn't admit it. When he said his Jordan's last amendment was strike the last eight lines of both impeachment articles, basically was saying, we'll vote for an article that says the president did this. We just don't believe it's impeachable. Heard took a different tact, which was to argue not proven.
So the other part is that is, I think, rather extraordinary, and I'm trying to work through this, and I'm hoping to get some more insight. Eric Erickson has a piece up, and I disagree with him on this rather fundamentally. But he points out that there are, I think, 21 retiring Republicans. So there are 21 people who, in theory, don't have to worry about Donald Trump's tweets, don't have to worry about being primaried. And yet, right now, it looks like none of them, or hardly any of them, are going to get to yes on impeachment. And his argument is this. He said a few of those Republicans might change their mind by next week and give the Democrats a bipartisan vote. Right now, it looks like the Democrats will lose more votes on impeachment than they will gain from Republicans, which is an ouch. And then he goes on, he says, Democrats are not even trying. The press is not trying. The anti-Trump pundits are shaming Republicans and yelling about propping up bigots and the right and wrong side of history, which I think is a legitimate thing to say. But not one of them has tried to convince these 21 Republicans to find out what they might need to get to yes on impeachment. Okay, so I'm not sure exactly what he thinks, but it is rather extraordinary that you have, there are these targets out there that ought to be very plausible yes votes on impeachment. So has there been a failure of messaging? Has there been a failure of outreach?
I don't think so, because what we have seen is an unwillingness to even recognize the basic truth. We haven't seen an acknowledgement of basic facts. You know, just earlier this morning, after the impeachment vote, Congresswoman Klesko, I believe her name, from Arizona, was asked by Manu Raju of CNN, is it ever right for a president to ask a foreign leader to investigate an opponent? And she said, Trump didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Manu said, yes, he did. He did that to Zelensky. And she said, no, he didn't. Now, as to the 21, I think this is a broader conversation about the modern political era. I think we have, in today's political climate, a generation of political leaders that have been indoctrinated in hyper-partisanship. And it's a more granular conversation to have around policy about gerrymandering and closed primaries and big money and new media and all these other issues. Those are legitimate policy debates. But if you took a snapshot of this political era, the elected leaders are all products of that hyper-partisanship,
yeah,
and were elected and reelected through a reward system that rewards hyper-partisanship. Gone are the members that represented 50-50 districts, your Blue Dog Democrats, your Tuesday Group Republicans. That is the group that has been shattered by Trumpism, but also by the mechanics of hyper-partisan gerrymandering and money and all these other influences. So I don't think we can look for leadership even from members who are retiring, because I don't think they showed it or experienced it when they were in office.
Okay, so now here's a tougher question. Given the fact that Mitch McConnell has essentially said that the trial is going to be rigged, although as we have the caveat that he needs 51 votes in order to do that, is there any validity in some of the suggestions that are floated out there that maybe what the House should do is vote next week, but then hold off on sending it to the Senate so that they will be able to continue investigation, continue some of the litigation, continue to have public opinion ripen? Is would there be any reason for Nancy Pelosi to say, look, based on Mitch McConnell's comments, we're going to wait on sending this over there until we are assured that there is actually going to be a fair and reasonable trial? Would that sell? Or are they really committed now to just sort of checking the box and getting it done as quickly as possible?
I think for reasons of prudence, they should consider holding it, because I also wrestle with another question, which is, what about the president's next impeachable moment?
I mean, to think
that the president will go through all of 2020 without engaging in behavior that rises to the level of impeachment, for me, is a leap of faith I'm not willing to take. So do you withhold the two articles right now from referral to the Senate, which you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Procedurally, what happens is when the House passes its resolution next week, one of the last paragraphs said, will say, and these articles are hereby referred to the United States Senate. They don't have to refer it to the Senate. McConnell can't bring it up if the articles are not referred by the House. So they could hold it. They could hold the articles to see if there are more assurances. Could Schumer and McConnell reach a deal as to how the trial will go forward? Or should they hold it until next summer till they know for certain, okay, we're ready to move because we've seen all of the president's activity. Suppose his tax returns come forward. Suppose there's something related to a private dealing. All of those questions in the Trump presidency are new territory for a Congress. So I would say, sure, hold it out of reasons for prudence, because the alternative is to hand it over to a majority leader who, you rightly point out, Charlie, has already said, don't worry, I'm going to fix this trial to make sure the president's acquitted.
This is very interesting to me, because the strongest case for a quick vote, and we have Ben Parker making this case in the Bulwark today for a quick vote, is that it's an act of deterrence, is that you need to basically fire a shot across the bow so that the president will not engage in this sort of behavior before. But the flip side of that is that a quick acquittal would be treated as an exoneration and might embolden and empower the president. So there was a piece in Politico that I think goes exactly to the point you're making here. Democrats are only just beginning to confront the paradox that their imminent impeachment vote creates. What happens when a remorseless president commits the same behavior that got him impeached in the first place, only this time after the House has already deployed the most potent weapon in its arsenal? There's no roadmap for Congress to handle an already impeached president who could have as many as 5 years left in office. So this is the question. I mean, right now, I mean, it's hard. You shoot at the king once. You don't get to keep shooting at him. So far from being deterred by this, Trump is acting like he's emboldened, suggesting that impeachment may not be the kind of bulwark against misconduct envisioned in the Constitution. Like, whoa, that is a scary thought to me.
Well, it is, and I would say you could impeach the president a second time.
You could.
Suppose there was behavior so compelling that even then 15 or 17 Republican senators said, yes, okay, we have to remove him. But presuming that doesn't happen, your question of deterrence is such a fascinating one, because the way I read Donald Trump is as somebody who does not respond to punishment as a deterrent. He doesn't care. He doesn't recognize the co-equal branch or the validity of what Congress is doing, so it's not a deterrent. The only elements of deterrence I see Donald Trump deriving from the impeachment in the House is that he thinks he has snakes around him in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
He now has to guard his behavior more closely, not from the Congress because he doesn't care, but from the government employees around him, because unlike the Trump organization where he can control everybody and it's a close-knit organization, I think this has taught him that the organization of the executive office of the president and of the White House and of the executive branch of the government is beyond his ability to completely control. You know, one of the impeachment articles against Bill Clinton was not obstruction of Congress over asserting privilege like we're seeing with Donald Trump. It was over actually trying to influence the testimony of witnesses. Mm-hmm. Monica Lewinsky being one, and I believe Betty Curry was Bill Clinton's secretary. The obstruction charge against Clinton was trying to influence the opinion or the testimony, to try to create false. Trump is realizing in his role as president, he can't control everybody around him. And to me, that is probably the only element of deterrence that he is deriving from this, but one that he thinks he can fix because he's fixed it before in the Trump organization.
See, well, you're actually making a compelling case for keeping this hanging over his head, because once that Senate vote takes place, all of that deterrence is gone, and I'm just watching what's happening right now. I mean, among the many grotesquely undercovered stories of the week, the brazenness of having the Russian foreign minister come into the Oval Office for a private meeting while all this is going on, the brazenness of having Rudy Giuliani continue this, like, ongoing
exactly
crime
right.
scene, continuing to dig up dirt in the Ukraine, coming back and still talking to the president, saying he's got all kinds of stuff, goes to the White House today. So while this is pending, he's doing it. We've also seen the willingness of the attorney general to bend the Department of Justice to the president's will. So the possibilities of what an unleashed Trump would do in this term, I think ought to at least get people to think, all right, do we really want this to be over, or do we want to continue the narrative over the next, you know, 6 months or so? This is a president who is covering up, he's obstructing justice, he is attacking constitutional norms, he is rigging the system, and he is prepared to undermine the rule of law. And the legitimacy, of course, I think of, you know, of I'm trying to talk myself into this now. I probably shouldn't be talking, you know, thinking out loud on a podcast, which people might actually hear, is that you can make the case that based on McConnell's points, there's no sense in sending it over to the Senate right now. But also, I do understand the argument that litigation takes a long time. But I also think that there is a possibility that if you go to the Supreme Court and say we are in a constitutionally mandated impeachment proceeding, we want an expedited decision on this obstruction of justice, because the fact is that right now not a single piece of paper has been, not a single document, with the exception of that one call readout, has been produced. Key witnesses who obviously have important things to say, you know, have either, you know, refused to testify or not even been subpoenaed. So I think you can make a case to do that, but I don't think there's the political will there. But the more I think about it, I think the real danger right now is letting him off the hook too early.
Well, and the audacity of Donald Trump, as you mentioned, having the Russian foreign minister and Giuliani in the White House this week while this is occurring is similar to the audacity of him making the Zelensky phone call and request the day after the Mueller testimony.
That's exactly
this
right.
Is a president where actions on Capitol Hill do not provide the deterrence. And so I would suggest as well, we consider, you know, is it a bargain with ourselves as a nation as to what is the significance of impeachment by the House? Because if we presume the fix is in the Senate, is it sufficient that the House of Representatives has formally condemned Donald Trump to say that he has impugned the office and he should be disqualified from holding a position of trust or honor or profit in the United States going forward? Because that is what the House Judiciary Committee passed today. And Donald Trump, for all of the powers of the White House and the presidency, it does not include the power to rewrite history. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's history now is one in which he has been impeached by the House Judiciary Committee and presumably next week by the full House. Is that sufficient retribution on behalf of a nation? Is that sufficient condemnation on behalf of a nation? It may be the only condemnation we can achieve with this president as long as Mitch McConnell is the majority leader of the Senate. And so if that is our analysis, then why move it over to an illegitimate process in the United States Senate? Because it bears no additional value of accountability through the long lens of history. We have achieved that, or will achieve that, next week with a full vote of the House. That would be a compelling argument to simply not refer it, and it would be a condemnation of Mitch McConnell's tenure as well. That on the record, on television, he said he was going to work with the defendant to rig this. That is sufficient reason to record for history.
I think so too.
That the Senate could not be trusted with an impartial trial.
I couldn't agree more with you. Maybe I'll write something about that. Okay, so I want to talk about another major,
<I'll read it. laughs>
a major political development over the last 24 hours, and how that is going to shake up. But first, here's a word from our sponsors at ZipRecruiter.
Hiring is challenging, and it used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter. In fact, go to ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you cannot miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within within the first day. Right now, listeners here can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ziprecruiter.com/begin. That's ziprecruiter.com/BEGIN. ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, we're back with former Congressman David Jolly. There's so many things that are going on here. But let's talk about what happened in Great Britain yesterday. And it may seem one-off, but Boris Johnson not only won, he won this overwhelming landslide. The Conservative Party will now have as big a majority as they've had since Margaret Thatcher's landslide back in the 1980s. And, of course, everybody is spinning it. But here's my question. Boris Johnson was not that popular. He had a lot of baggage. Brexit is not that overwhelmingly popular. I think by a 9-point margin, voters are, kind of having, second thoughts about it. And yet he blows out the Labour Party. The Labour Party, headed by Jeremy Corbyn, tested the thesis, what happens if we move hard left? If we call for all kinds of free stuff, massive increases in spending, new taxes, more government power, really kind of the democratic socialist fever dream. And the result was an electoral shellacking for the ages. This is a cautionary warning for the Democrats and the left in this country, isn't it?
I'm always hesitant to translate politics of another nation's domestic elections to ours. What I would say is I think globally we have seen a growing distrust and, more importantly, dislike for government as an actor. And alternatively, we have seen voting populations put their trust in a disruptive figure. Some of that is the new era in which we're living and how we promote leaders and how leaders have the ability to emerge through non-traditional political channels at times. But we have seen leaders. Donald Trump is a perfect example, if there is a translation, of somebody who seized on angry populism, not as an ideology, but as a fervor and as a resentment of government as an actor. So to the extent that there is any translation, and I am very hesitant, It is clear from our own election in 2016, notwithstanding Boris Johnson's of earlier this week, that there is a large portion of the country that is distrustful in the United States of government making decisions for them. Now, that large portion is 3 million people less than pulled the lever for Hillary Clinton. You could make that argument if you have your blue hat on, and I think we'll hear Democrats make that argument going into 2020.
Yeah, I'm less hesitant to do it. I mean, obviously, British politics is very different, but there is an analogy there that if, in fact, one of the major political parties is led by somebody who is absolutely politically toxic, out of the political mainstream, that bad things are going to happen. And I ran through all of, actually, Jonathan Chait did a masterful job over at New York Magazine of pulling together all of the articles written by pundits and progressives who were pointing to Jeremy Corbyn and said, we should do that here. We should follow his lead. Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn are on the same track. I would suggest that they would rethink that particular take in the wake of what happened, because this was an absolute stomping of the party. Not to mention, and obviously we can't talk about Jeremy Corbyn without talking about the toxic anti-Semitism. I don't know how big a role that played, but the repudiation of that, I think, was really a good thing to come out of that election. I thought it was very interesting. There was a tweet from one of the Labour MPs who said he had gone to thousands of doors. And he said, overwhelmingly, what people wanted to talk about was not Brexit. They wanted to talk about Jeremy Corbyn and how unpopular he was and how frightened they were of the really radical left agenda that the Labour Party was pushing. And you kind of hope that Britain will, as a result of this, move back toward a reasonable center-left party as well as a reasonable center-right party, but who knows? So you mentioned something else in the time that we have left here. You are spending some time in the heart of Trump country, and so you've
that's right.
You've gotten out of our little bubble. here for a while.
That's right.
Give me a sense of what that's like. I mean, it is a different political universe, isn't it?
It is an entirely different political universe. And you're right. I'm in a portion of very rural America, very red Republican country, probably 75-25%. And I am embarking on it very constructively and respectfully, because it's very informative to recognize the diversity of opinion in the country and to recognize that, you know, one of the conversations even among a voter who is leaning Democratic in the next election but has union-based health care has strong concerns about a Medicare for All program, for instance. But then you move to the pure Trump fealty constituency, and it does show the breakdown nationally in building consensus among the two sides. And, you know, often I would say pundits and observers make the mistake of thinking that rural red America, flyover states, is uninformed on the issues. That is not true. They are just as informed as people on the East Coast and West Coast and in urban areas. Their opinions just are informed by different priorities, largely the economy, an economy that is regionally based, not a nationally based, international based information economy. And so there are conversations about the House Intelligence Committee. I drove by a homemade sign, Charlie. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Somebody put out a homemade sign that said, "How can the House Intelligence Committee be made up of so many stupid people?" That was a homemade sign on the side of a country road in rural America, because people are paying attention. They just don't reach the same conclusion sometimes as the rest of us. That's right. That's right.
Well, and there's also, I mean, there's a native common sense that I think tends to get overlooked. And I think one of the problems that we have in our nation's politics is how quick we are to label and dismiss and insult voters who might not agree with us immediately. So that, yes, there's no question about it that race is a massively important issue and white supremacy is obviously a serious issue. But to label all the voters in rural Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin, to label them bigots because they didn't vote for Hillary Clinton is for me kind of a whoa moment.
You
may not win them over, but you're certainly not. You may not ultimately win them over, but you're certainly not going to win them over if your opening gambit is to insult them and to alienate them.
Right. And I think that's important to keep in context that in Trump's Republican Party, while we have seen people with, frankly, white supremacy ideologies move towards Trump, that does not mean that the people who are with Trump all reflect those lack of values and that hatred of spirit. There are across the country, urban, suburban areas, coastal individuals and flyover state individuals who are simply low to medium information voters,
yeah.
Right? They are more concerned and prioritize their family, their faith, their church, their civic organization, their school than they do politics. They put their trust in local elected officials and they don't worry about the day to day of it. And what I will tell you is, as a indicator for some of these constituencies, is the economy is doing relatively well. Gas prices are low. Those are two things you notice in rural America. And so if you're a low information voter, you have to be convinced to pull the lever for change in 2020. And I think that's the challenge and the opportunity for Democrats. What is the change? Because if you're making it the argument simply around cultural issues, it's not going to land with a lot of constituencies who don't recognize the allegations of, say, white supremacy, when for them, the issue is simply, can I trust my government to keep the economy moving forward so I can spend valuable time with my family, my church, and my school? And for a lot of people in America right now, they would say they don't need change. They're okay with the direction. That's the challenge and opportunity for Democrats in their case to make going into next year.
So what's your evaluation of the state of the race on the Democratic side? I'm struck by the resilience of Joe Biden and the fact that he's still in the lead despite everything. And I continue to be, and this is probably the kiss of death for him, but continue to be impressed by the political instincts of Pete Buttigieg. And thinking, you know, this guy's 37 years old, yeah, from South Bend, Indiana, and he has got an ear for politics that is really quite extraordinary. I don't think he's going to win the nomination, but I continue to be impressed by him and the way he's handling the really vicious attacks he's getting from the Bernie Sanders and from Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
Very, very skilled. And I'm trying to remember the last time
that, he is.
I'm trying to remember the last time there was somebody of this skill level. Maybe a guy like Bill Clinton or something. But
sure. No, you're right. And understanding the precise language of where the heartbeat of politics are nationally, at least consensus, right? And what I find remarkable about Mayor Pete is he kind of burst on the scene and he ended up at 5 or 6% for reasons nothing more than just the energy around him and his ability to make an impression of competence and skill. But he seemed to hit a ceiling for a few months.
Yeah.
And there were a few months where he had a ceiling. He broke through that ceiling a couple months back. And one of the indicators, I think, to your point of how smart he is, not just in political skill, but in understanding where the constituencies across the country are, was on this issue of how a Medicare for All plan might not be in the best interest of public pensioners who have state or local health care plans.
Right.
That was one of the reasons they stayed with their state or local employee for an entire career. And Mayor Pete tried to speak to that constituency because he saw it more closely in Indiana and throughout states in the Midwest. Look, I think Democrats, despite our previous conversation about Trump country, I still would give the nod slightly towards Democrats going into 2020 because, first and foremost, I think Trump has blown it with the swing voters that put him over the edge last time. I just think there is too much Trump fatigue for Trump to be able to replicate precisely what he did in 2016. I think the opportunity is there for any of the leading Democrats to win this. But I don't think it would be by a landslide, because what we know is Donald Trump is going to label the next nominee of the Democratic Party as a socialist and a criminal. That's going to happen regardless if it's Biden, Mayor Pete, if it's Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, whomever it might be.
Yeah, I think that is the safest prediction that any of us are going to make. David Jolly, thank you so much for joining us again, and I hope you have a great weekend.
You too. Great to be with you. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.